Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Katie Britton. Ali Benjamin's The Thing About Jellyfish is delightfully witty and heartbreakingly tragic as 12-year-old Susie looks for a reason why her best friend has died. Even though Susie has taken a vow of silence in the outside world, her mind is racing as she recalls her friendship with Franny, why they began to grow apart, and an obsession with jellyfish that might give her the answers she's looking for.
Well, Susie's a very different kind of kid, and she doesn't always do the right thing. I've always been interested in books where there's a main character who isn't perfect, who is flawed, and the reader can see the flaws and they can see what they're doing wrong, and yet it still is understandable. There's still a logic to it from that character's perspective. And there's a little bit of me in Susie, and I'm sort of fascinated by the natural world. When I was growing up, I did not always understand all the social cues. I think I still don't, but Susie is maybe an extreme version of that, and I find her flaws so sympathetic and really interesting. I like viewing the world through somebody else's eyes.
And unfortunately, we learn at the beginning of the book that her best friend has died, and she's only 12, which is,
right.
At that point, you know that when somebody is dead, they are dead, but you want answers as to why. And the answer her mother gives her, which is sometimes things just happen, isn't enough for Susie.
That's right. I think at any age, we struggle with why bad things happen to good people and why people die and why there are tragedies. And I feel like even as an adult, I still try to make sense of things. And sometimes there's no sense to them. And in those situations, there's not a satisfactory answer. There's never a satisfactory answer. Even for adults, even for those of us who have experience and who know how the world works. And so much of growing up is crossing that threshold between a world where you believe that things are fair and a world where you understand that things aren't fair and they're not going to be fair. And I can remember all different incidences in my own growing up of just wrestling with that idea of, but that's not fair. And fair didn't matter. That's the way the world was. So Susie is at that point in her life that I think is a very 12-year-old thing to be wrestling with these ideas of fairness and justice in a world where sometimes fairness and justice don't exist. And it's compounded by this extremely permanent thing that has happened. She had a best friend, and that best friend is gone. And there is no satisfactory answer, and there's no making that better. So it does start off in that place, yeah.
And she stops talking. She decides, you know what, why fill the space with jibber-jabber and nobody's really listening to anybody else. They're not giving me the answers that I need, so I'm going to stop talking. And she does to everybody for months.
Yeah, she does. And I'll have two things to say about that. One is I've lived overseas and I've lived in cultures where small talk is not a thing and it's perfectly acceptable to visit with somebody and sit down with them and just sit in silence. And when I first started doing that, it was incredibly uncomfortable to me, but it sort of gave me this perspective that actually you can sit with somebody, you can be in silence and have it be completely comfortable. And so I think I was bringing that perspective to the book, and I have children, and I do try to train them in social niceties, and how do you make small talk, and I just think small talk is an interesting question. All these times that we're saying something, and we're not really saying anything important, and yet we're choosing to fill empty spaces with words, so there's that aspect of it.
It's interesting how other people are reacting to this, because her parents, who are divorced, have decided that she needs to go see a therapist to get past. They think it's because Franny has died and that she is just shut down. And it freaks people out having that silence. But her brother and his boyfriend, they're pretty cool about it. They'll talk to her knowing that they won't get an answer, but just, you know, say things to her and that this is this. And the boyfriend, Rocco, he'll quote some poet. And it really gives her something to think about. And I think that silence has made her into a more inquisitive person, and it makes her want to know more about what people are saying and doing.
Yeah, I think that's right. I do have two children, and as I was writing this book, there was always the question in the back of my mind, what would I do in this situation? What would I do if my own child were sort of deliberately not engaging and sort of disappearing into her own world? And I think the thing I would hope I would do would be to continue to love her and also to leave a door open, to make sure that that door never got so shut that she couldn't walk back into the world. And part of the reason she's silent is there is a story she needs to tell herself. She needs to figure out what happened. She had a friend. The friendship had fallen apart. And then this friend died before she had a chance to make it better. And she needs to figure that out before she can reengage with the world. So her silence is, it's almost a self-imposed meditation as she tells herself a story and as she is telling the story of this friendship to herself. In a funny way, throughout the book, she is talking. She's talking to her former friend, and she's telling her former friend the story of their friendship and how it happened and how it fell apart and how she lost her.
Because she had so much admiration for Franny. And while Susie is very, very smart, and she's such a clever young lady, I mean, the wit that she has in this book and the way that she's able to play with words, and that really attracted Franny to her, whereas Franny, she was a lot of fun, and she was a little bit quirky as well. And that's why Susie bonded with her.
Right, and they're extremely different kids, and they were compatible for a very long time. And then as they got older, things changed, and suddenly they weren't as compatible. And maybe they would have gotten there again, but maybe not, because sometimes friendships just don't work forever. Sometimes we lose friends through no fault of our own, but just because we grow in really different directions. And I'm so fascinated by middle school, because that is an age where we really start to become who we are going to be. In elementary school, everybody's kind of in the same boat, and everybody's kind of equal, and everybody can generally manage to play with one another and find things in one another. And then in middle school, we start to differentiate, and we start to move down different paths, and that's okay. It's okay, but it's strange, and sometimes it hurts.
And scary. So many middle schools have tons of elementary schools coming in, and that's what's happening at their middle school as well, that new people come into their lives. And as you say, I mean, they started drifting apart. Well, Franny started drifting away, and Susie just didn't realize it. And earlier you said that she didn't understand the social cues, but she just wanted her friend back to do the fun, quirky things that they had always done together.
Right, and I think Franny was growing up a little bit faster than Susie, because that's another thing that happens at that age, is there can be vast differences between where kids are physically and developmentally, and some kids behave much more like teenagers, and some kids behave much more like elementary school kids, and yet they're all jumbled up there together, and it feels like those differences are going to last forever. Once we get out of middle school, once we all grow up, we have that perspective that it all evens out eventually. But when you're in that moment, it does not feel like it's ever going to even out. It just feels like the differences that are there, the developmental differences, the physical differences, are permanent and lasting. And it can be really overwhelming for a kid.
Oh, it can. And that brings us to the jellyfish, because being silent, you almost become a shadow. Because you're not vying for anybody's attentions, you're not vying for friendships. And so Susie just does her own thing. So they were at the aquarium, and she found the jellyfish exhibit. And that started clicking into place of her looking for and finding a reason why Franny had died.
That's right. That's right. She is a kid who desperately wants explanations for things. She doesn't like ambiguities. She's a very literal kid. And when the book starts off, her friend has already passed away. We don't necessarily know what happened in their friendship, but that has already happened. And she's standing in the middle of a noisy aquarium looking around at all of these kids in her class that she feels like she has nothing in common with. And all she can do is walk away, and she sort of retreats into this silent exhibit, which is the jellyfish exhibit, which is at the New England Aquarium. It's one of the quieter places in the whole aquarium, and she just starts seeing these strange alien creatures pulsing behind glass, and they're absolutely silent, and they're really haunting and eerie. And she reads about this one jellyfish that's rare but very, very dangerous. And she starts to get this idea that perhaps a jellyfish sting was behind her friend's death. And she then becomes obsessed with proving scientifically that that is what happened to her friend.
And she's so methodical about it. I mean, we really start rooting for her and saying, yes, you're on the right track. You're looking for these scientists. And she's also keeping a journal of what scientists study, which parts about jellyfish, and whether they're worth contacting because of how they look, if they look nice, or what they're studying, and if they'll be able to give her the information that she needs.
Right. She feels very alone in this quest. She feels very alone in her grief, and she's trying to find somebody who can help her. She feels like this is perhaps a last act of friendship she can perform for her friend. This is sort of a way of making things right again to prove the true cause of her friend's death. And so she's searching for someone who can help her. And she is a 12-year-old kid. She's not a scientist. She doesn't really even know how to begin proving something this big and this complicated. And so she knows she needs an adult to help her. And she begins just one by one looking up jellyfish researchers, different people who have experiences with jellyfish, who can help her through this thing she's trying to do. And she does settle on one, and he's all the way across the world in Australia.
And she also has a friend in one of the teachers. And I think that's one of the things about middle school is that when you think it's just so bad, so horrible, everything is not going that well, there's usually that one teacher that just helps everything click together. And Mrs. Turton is that person for her.
The science teacher. That's right. Mrs. Turton is very warm, very engaging, and very forgiving. She sees that Susie is struggling, and she doesn't force her to immediately get better. She just lets her be. She lets her be awkward. She gives her a space where she can be awkward and silent and alone, and just introduces new ideas to her very quietly, very subtly, but just kind of gives her a space to be herself in the middle of this world of middle school where she doesn't feel like she's worth very much or doesn't feel like she's able to be herself or make herself understood.
Mrs. Turton was just such a wonderful breath of fresh air in this novel. And it just reminded me of so many of my middle school teachers, of the love for teaching and also helping to guide.
Yeah. Yeah, Mrs. Turton, I love Mrs. Turton, and she represents the very best teachers that I myself have had, the very best teachers that my kids have had. Though the kind of teacher who just allows kids to be themselves and who enjoys them no matter what they're bringing into the room, who just wants to help bring out their best and understands that every kid is going to respond differently to different things, and really treats them like an individual worth valuing.
Now, you will be at Oblong Books on September 26th to talk about the book, and you get to meet a lot of your young readers. How is that experience for you? Do you like getting their ideas and what their thoughts are on the different characters and what's happening in the novels?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that's been really interesting to me, is seeing how many different perspectives come to reading this book. I had one thing in mind. I experienced it one way, but in the end, the book doesn't belong to me. It belongs to those who read it, and they have their own experiences. And I'll say right off the bat, not all of them like Susie. I love Susie, but some of them get really angry with her because she is really flawed, and she does some things that we, the reader, can see she's doing the wrong thing, and she does them anyway. And I find it forgivable. Not everybody does. And to me, that's interesting, and that's part of the process.
Well, the name of the book is The Thing About Jellyfish. Allie, thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing you in Rhinebeck.
Great. Thanks so much.
Again, the name of Ali Benjamin's novel is The Thing About Jellyfish. It is published by Little Brown. And readers can meet Ali Benjamin along with author Rebecca Steed at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck, New York, this Saturday, September 26th at 2 p.m. For more information, visit WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.